This podcast was recorded Thursday, February 18th at 11:08 a.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear it.
Yeah, like scientists will come to discover a polar vortex wipes out coronaviruses.
This cold weather is bound to keep us inside and away from each other, at least. That'll help.
Good for us, I guess.
Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all those Snollygosters who shrewdly make their way to Columbus to do the state's business, unless, of course, there's a little snow on the roads. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson. Coming up later in the podcast, the official Republican field for U.S. Senate doubles.
But first, Governor DeWine has had plenty to be annoyed about over the past year. But he rarely shows up in public. There was that time over a year ago when he called out reporters to the statehouse to complain that the FDA did not give immediate approval to Battelle's hospital mask cleaning system. Remember that, Mike? Seems like a generation ago at this point.
I remember that. And then, well, last week he called another emergency news conference at 6 o'clock on a Friday evening, making the press corps very pleased, I'm sure. Well, this one was to complain that some school districts were not living up to promises to get kids back in the classroom in exchange for his decision to vaccinate teachers ahead of other people in Ohio.
Last week, the governor called out Akron and Cleveland and one high school in Cincinnati and threatened to make teachers wait their turn for vaccines if their school districts did not restore in-person learning by March 1st. Then this week, he added Columbus City Schools to that list.
If the school is not going to have every student back in fully in-person or hybrid by March 1, then they're breaking the agreement.
Democrats, school officials, and teachers' union representatives immediately pushed back. Democratic leaders at the State House say DeWine is to blame for mismanaging the COVID vaccine distribution. Columbus Board of Education President Jennifer Adair had some especially harsh words for the governor.
It's pretty sad, though, that our state government doesn't want to be a partner and instead want to chastise and blame and hold hostage in some ways local school districts when they're just trying to do the best they can.
And this whole fight comes as the Centers for Disease Control has issued new guidelines saying basically that it's pretty safe to resume in-person instruction. And Ohio Education Department research shows attendance and performance are suffering because of the pandemic.
No surprise there, obviously. Joining us now to discuss what it's going to take to get more kids into the classroom for more of the school week is the president of the Ohio Education Association, Scott DeMauro. Thanks for joining us again. Everyone wants kids back in the classroom, but you know, most people want it done safely to protect students, teachers, and prevent the spread of COVID to the wider community. In your mind, what is the biggest one thing that needs to be done to get students back into the classroom?
Well, it was interesting that the governor, the day that he had his press conference, neglected to mention that the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, put out its roadmap for how schools should be operating safely for in-person instruction. And they laid out 5 core mitigation strategies. One which I think is going pretty well here, and that is consistent use of mask wearing by both staff and students. That is one area where I think we're ahead of a few other states, but common sense, we need to continue to do that. But we need to make sure that all those mitigation strategies are being used and consistently across the state. Vaccines are an important layer of protection. It's great that school employees are being vaccinated, but our students aren't going to be vaccinated for quite some time. And we've got some adults that aren't able to be vaccinated. So that means we need to continue to pay close attention to what the CDC says is required, and that is 6 feet of physical distancing, unless the level of community spread is at a safe level. And they're defining that as less than 50 new cases per 100,000 people over the past week, or less than 5% positivity rate. So 6 feet of physical distancing. Governor doesn't tend to want to talk about that very much, but also, you know, maintaining solid protocols related to testing and tracing and quarantining people that are exposed to the virus, making sure that we've got sanitizing and good ventilation systems operating in our schools. And then, of course, making sure that people are practicing good personal, you know, sanitizing with hand washing and things like that.
Scott, those are a lot of conditions, but the governor says that basically there was one condition for getting kids back, at least in a hybrid mode, you know, part of the week in the classroom. And that was you teachers, school employees get vaccinated, kids are back March 1st. Are you changing the rules? Are you setting the bar higher now by asking for all these other things to happen?
No, I mean, for one thing, those expectations have been in place, you know, from the beginning. We were appreciative of the governor, including school employees. We do think that it does provide an additional layer of protection. We think that that's important. But the governor did set an arbitrary deadline when it comes to March 1st by his own plan. You know, we have many school employees across the state that aren't even going to get their first dose until right up before March 1st, you know, because it got spread out over 4 weeks. And so some people are getting their first shot right at the end of next week. So it takes a little bit of time for both doses for full, you know, protection to take place. But even with that, students aren't going to be vaccinated. A lot of adults aren't going to be vaccinated. We need to make sure that conditions are safe. Of course, we want to be in person with our students. Over 86% of teachers across the state are already providing in-person instruction in our schools. We know that there is no substitute for the kind of connection and support that exists between educators and classrooms in our school buildings. And that is even more acutely felt in places like Columbus, where you have a lot of students that just don't have a lot of resources at home to support them in their learning. But conditions have to be safe. We've been consistent about that. The bar has not changed on that. But sometimes the governor chooses to kind of, you know, change what his standard is when it comes to that.
Scott, you call the March 1st deadline arbitrary. Even if it is arbitrary, it was an agreement that districts agreed to. How many of these other things like mask wearing, physical distancing, sanitizing, ventilation, how much of that falls to local communities? Governor DeWine has relied on local communities a lot to draft their own plans as far as these things go.
There is, it's a partnership for sure. Local communities, school districts working in conjunction with their local health departments need to make sure that those, you know, protocols are in place. But there is a need for resources. You know, one of the challenges that Columbus has pointed out are systemic issues that existed long before COVID, you know, was an issue. And that is, number one, a shortage of substitute teachers and staff to make sure that we're adequately covering our schools. There is no one, you know, you put whatever date you want on there. If you have a shortage of teachers, a shortage of bus drivers at any given time because of an outbreak in the virus, you're not going to be able to fully staff your building. And we have seen all year long, all across the state, schools that have had to go back and forth between in-person and remote instruction because they just simply didn't have enough people to provide that support for students and meet those needs. The other issue that is a systemic issue, in particular in Columbus, is the issue of transportation. And, you know, the law requires that schools bus not just students attending public schools, but students attending private schools and charter schools in their communities. Mm-hmm. Columbus has some like 13,000 students that they're already transporting to school. That's more than the entire student population of Worthington. And it's actually more than the entire student population of all but 12 districts across the state. And so when you're trying to do that safely, not only do you have a shortage of bus drivers, but you also have these other students that you're required to transport, it's creating a real dilemma for the Columbus school district to figure out how do they transport all the students that they want to get back in their building.
Yeah, at this point, they still have not brought middle school and high school students back because of a lack of transportation. Not to make the show too Columbus-centric, but the local right. teachers union did say, we think this is, quote, outrageous, and the governor should waive this requirement. I spoke to the transportation director in Columbus, Stephen McElroy. He didn't want to weigh in on what he saw as a political situation. Scott, all these details are really interesting as far as policy and the science behind coronavirus. Looking at the politics of this, Governor DeWine uses a Friday night address to call out teachers. Does that fracture the relationship, or how did teachers process that?
I mean, I my phone was lighting up, and actually, I'll tell you, I'm a high school social studies teacher. I spent most of my career teaching in Worthington, and you know, this that announcement just brought me, you know, reminded me of what I've always believed as a teacher, and that is that if you have a problem with a couple of kids, you don't yell at the whole class. Mm-hmm. You certainly don't do it at 6 o'clock on a Friday. You know, but so that it was just a little odd. It's like if there are some challenges that a handful of districts are dealing with, as the vast majority of people are getting it done and figuring out one way or another to do it, then it would seem, again, continuing that analogy, if I have an issue with some students, then I'm going to work with those students to identify their needs and to help support them. So I don't know exactly what he was trying to do, unless the audience was people other than the folks in these districts, where he's trying to, like, you know, take a get tough stance, or, you know, worried about people. And you know, he's, I don't know how much of it's deflection. I don't know how much of it is saber rattling, but certainly it wasn't productive in terms of building a relationship of trust and support between the governor and Ohio's educators.
Yeah, we certainly didn't see that saber rattling when it came to bars that weren't adhering to the curfew or not adhering to social distancing guidelines and things like that. And the other thing that struck me is his stats show that schools are on the right track. He mentioned even on Tuesday at his briefing that in the start of January, which is just 6 weeks ago, 47% of the schools in Ohio were fully remote. And now we're down to 15%, and he hoped that would even be lower later in the week. So it might even be lower when he has his news conference today. 219 school districts in January, the start of January, were fully remote. Now we're down to 31. I think he is particularly, in defense of the governor, he is particularly targeting, he thinks the urban districts are dragging their feet, and those are the kids he claims are the ones who really need the help. Scott, are the urban districts dragging their feet a bit, perhaps being given too much deference to you know, local teachers' unions, maybe asking for too much in addition to the vaccines?
No, I don't think that's the case at all. And one thing that I'll point out is that, you know, the number of schools that are providing in-person instruction is lower than it was in January, because the number of cases of COVID in those communities is lower than it was as well. We saw a significant shift to remote learning as COVID cases were spiking in November and December. We came out and encouraged extensions of breaks and remote learning to try to get things under control. Unfortunately, a lot of districts did that, and I think that helped to contain the spread. But as far as, like, the issues that schools are facing, you know, understand that urban districts do have a lot of needs that other districts don't. One of those has to do with facilities. You know, I was just talking to my counterpart from the Ohio Federation of Teachers. They represent teachers in Cleveland, you know, and they're doing an environmental study of their school buildings in Cleveland in order to make sure that they're safe. They need an influx of equipment, of fans and things like that. And unfortunately, a lot of buildings that don't even have windows. So you need to have safe conditions, but our large urban districts tend to have a concentration of old, dilapidated buildings because we have a system that is inequitable, that just hasn't kept up with those needs over the years. So this pandemic has put a spotlight on fundamental inequities in our education system, just like fundamental inequities in society as a whole, like in healthcare, that existed far before COVID. And in a lot of ways, it's made them worse. And it's really hard when you're dealing with challenges in resources and also students who have even greater needs than students in our more affluent communities. And so just simply flipping a switch and thinking that you can, you know, go back to normal, just it's a lot harder. And it takes time. And I know every single superintendent across the state who signed that form related to March 1st, in good faith, has been doing all they can to try to make sure that they're getting a return to in-person learning happening as quickly as it can possibly happen. Our members want to be back in person with their students, but we have to make sure that the conditions are safe. Resources are there. One piece of good news, what President Biden is pushing for in terms of the new $1.9 trillion COVID relief package includes $130 billion in targeted assistance to schools, one, to help them open safely, but secondly, to make sure that we're addressing the needs of students that have been disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. I think that's good. We need the state to provide those kinds of resources as well. You know, make sure that those student wellness funds that the governor is very proud of and should be, are being used in a way that give districts the support they need in order to operate safely.
Scott, what do you think happens on March 1st? When I talked to the Columbus Transportation Director, he didn't know. He said, well, I'm just going to keep following the direction of my superintendent. Do you think all these districts are back in some form of hybrid or full-time in-person learning? Or do you think they just, you know, for lack of a better term, thumb their nose at the governor and just stay remote? Or what do you think happens?
Well, I don't think there's any question that every district is in the process of transitioning to in-person instruction. And, you know, he singled out Akron, Cleveland, and now is talking about Columbus. All of those districts have students in their schools. But to think that it's going to happen in every building in every school, you know, I think still remains to be seen. And it's a question of whether the resources are there. Again, there are some things that are just beyond people's control, like are there enough people to make sure that classes are staffed? Are there enough people to make sure that bus routes are staffed? Those are some things that you know, make the situation a little bit unpredictable. But I know that there is very good movement and a very good faith effort across the board for doing all we can to make sure that those who want to have an in-person experience for their children have that opportunity as soon as it's possible.
Scott, this will end. The COVID thing will end, and we will get back to in-person learning. So how do we make up for this lost time? Do we need more time in the classroom when the cases are down, when everyone's vaccinated? Do we go to school part of this summer, like say go back in mid-July rather than mid-August? Thinking ahead, how does the system help these kids catch up? Because even kids in affluent districts who had to spend time at home, they have lost something over the past year.
I think we have to, that question is a critical question. The governor's asking that question. We're all asking ourselves, our members, that question. And every single district needs to be taking time right now. And every teacher is taking the time to assess the needs of their students and kind of determine what it is the kids need most so that we can give them support. Learning opportunities have been significantly disrupted, and it's been more so for communities of color. It's been more so for communities with high concentrations of poverty, you know, with chronic absenteeism, mental health challenges, things like that. I mean, those are real issues, and every single educator I know cares deeply about making sure that we address that. I think it's going to have to be a conversation that thinks about not just the short term, not just what happens this summer. And there may be very good arguments for expanded summer school programs and adjustments to the school year, particularly for targeted assistance to students who are identified as needing extra help. But I think we need to like start with really looking at the social and emotional needs of our kids. COVID has been traumatic for everybody, and it's been traumatic in different ways for students. You can't expect students to just kind of pick up where we would like them to be in their academic learning if we don't attend to their mental health needs first, if we don't make sure that we're doing what we can to reconnect them. I saw recently some news reports out of the UK that that the national strategy that's happening in Britain is that they're calling for a summer of play. So that as they, hopefully, as we transition out of COVID and back to some semblance of normalcy, that we're really building a foundation to allow for learning to happen as we move forward. I think we need to be thinking about how we use federal resources and how the state budget is set up so that not only are we looking at academic support, but we need a lot more nurses and counselors and school social workers. We need more paraprofessionals to provide individual tutoring assistance to students. We need to be paying attention to class size and making sure that we're able to really individualize support that our students need. Those are longer term issues. Counting on the president, I'm counting on the governor, I'm counting on the legislature to help us with that.
Yeah, smaller class sizes would help with that social distancing, right, Steve?
Yeah. My first grader, he has liked the smaller classes. He talks about how things go faster. And, you know, obviously he's not taking into account school budgets and the cost of PPE and all those things. But yeah.
Oh, come on.
he's a smart kid, but he's not quite that advanced. Scott DeMauro is the president of the Ohio Education Association. We've been talking about the brewing fight between teachers and Governor DeWine and schools over just how to safely reopen and get students back in physical classrooms. Scott DeMauro, thanks for your time.
Hey, it's been my pleasure.
Thank you, Scott.
We'll be right back.
Support comes from Smart Columbus, presenting Pivot, Central Ohio's free navigation app that is locally designed to help you get around the region using COTA, taxis, scooters, and more. Plan, book, and pay for your trips. It's simple. Download Pivot on Google Play or the App Store today.
Welcome back to Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media. Last week, former Ohio Treasurer Josh Mandel became the first official candidate in Ohio's 2022 Senate race. This week, he got some competition, Mike.
As predicted, former Ohio GOP chair Jane Timken is running, and an ad she dropped Thursday morning somehow has even more red meat than the interview Josh Mandel gave last week.
When I look at Washington today, I see threats to our freedoms that will jeopardize the futures of my kids and yours. Amnesty for 12 million illegal immigrants. The largest tax increase in American history. Liberal attacks on our energy jobs. We can't let America become a socialist country. I'm running for the United States Senate to stand up for you. Just like when I stood next to President Trump and supported his America First agenda.
And that audio ran over top of images of Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders. It also included references to abortion, gun rights, law enforcement, and, quote, cleaning house of the John Kasich establishment.
Red meat indeed. Nearly immediately after she entered the race, her Republican rival, Josh Mandel, tweeted an old photo of Jane Timken standing right next to John Kasich when they were best buds. And the first comment on Mandel's tweet, someone who we assume is not a Josh Mandel fan, posted an old picture of Josh Mandel standing affectionately close to John Kasich.
And that was during a Senate run. That was in Mandel's, presumably his last Senate run. He's made two.
Yes.
And then Twitter, as Twitter is known to do, took off and it became a Josh Mandel and John Kasich picture fest.
What we need is the three of them all together. Jane Timken, Josh Mandel, and John Kasich.
That
all
probably
together.
Exists, doesn't it?
I would assume.
What did Jane Timken do before she was the GOP chair? She was just a rich person?
She was, you know, she's got a pretty good story.
Well, she's from Timken Steel. Yeah, her family's are
steel. She married into the Timken Steel family, so she's a businesswoman and pretty active in Republican politics, though. She's not a stranger to politics, and She will be tough to beat. She has taken control of the Ohio Republican Party for the past several years. She has helped candidates up and down the ballot. She secured Donald Trump's win here in Ohio in 2020 by 8 points. And she will be tough to beat. It's funny, these two are going for the really, really, really pro-Trump vote.
Yeah,
no one's
they are.
Going to be anti-Trump on the Republican side, but will there be a more, we don't use the term moderate Republican, but a more reasonable Republican.
A Steve Stivers type.
A more establishment Republican to jump in. And if all three of them make it to the primary, then that would give the advantage to the, quote, establishment candidate, because the other two would split the vote. If there's only three, now there's like 20 that are considering it, right?
Yeah.
I don't know what we're down to now.
Because we work in news, we have to sign up for all these email lists, right? So I get inundated with political emails. The one I got from Josh Mandel this morning does not mention Jane Timken. It does say, though, that he's had enough. And it also says, day after day, socialism gains a stronger foothold in America as leftists continue to rally around the most radical agenda our nation has ever seen. And if we don't step up now, there may be no going back. So that's the focus of Josh Mandel's campaign as of this Thursday morning.
It's going to be interesting to see how long this lasts, how long this sort of the demonizing the, quote, radical left and how we're going to save the country from socialism lasts. Now that Donald Trump is off the stage, I know he appears on Fox News every once in a while, but no more Twitter. He may show up on Parler if that ever gets going again. And does that movement last without Trump? And how active will he be in this campaign and others around the country? And after the riot and the insurrection, will more people tune him out? It's really going to be interesting to watch over the next 6 months to see if the moment, this anti-socialist momentum continues.
Yeah, it was funny to watch.
In the Republican Party.
Yeah, to watch that Jane Timken ad, as she utters the word socialism, it's a picture of AOC. Because of course it is, right? I mean, that's what the Republican Party is going for these days. And yeah, and last week when Mandel was announcing his new run during the impeachment trial, so there was no shame, there was no, you know, reluctantly trying to court the Trump vote. He is all in. Jane Timken is all in, and it's going to be an interesting year because the primary still a year away, and yeah, we'll see what happens. Either
and
way,
Democrats are going to do the same thing. They're going to be showing Jim Jordan and Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and all of their ads saying that we don't want to go back to the video of the insurrection. So it's going to be as it always is, pretty nasty 2 years, 18 months.
Anyway, turn now to our Snollygoster of the Week segment. We know Texas has been hit hard by the polar vortex. Their energy grid became overloaded as everyone started running their furnaces on high and plugging in space heaters. What happened and who, if anyone, is to blame will be determined in the weeks to come. But of course, with anything, it cannot just be about cold weather. It has to be about politics.
Of course. And that's where Texas Governor Greg Abbott comes in. He told a Dallas TV station that frozen natural gas pipes and pumps were the primary cause of the electricity shutoffs in Texas. But later that day, he told Fox News and Sean Hannity that wind turbines were the main cause of the outages as he took a swipe at the Green New Deal.
And now the governor has since corrected himself and said, indeed, it was problems with natural gas lines that were the main problem. But for instinctively blaming the Green New Deal and frozen wind turbines for Texas's lack of electricity, Texas Governor Greg Abbott, you are our Snollygoster of the Week. If you have a suggestion for next week, you can send it to snollygoster@wosu.org. Also, be sure to leave us a good review on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. And as always, just tell your friends about us. For our audio producer, Kevin Petrilla, our student producer, Jack Long, and our web producer, Michael DeBonis, I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.